Today on Maine Calling, a love letter to oysters. More than a few people have come to Maine for a new kind of life, one closer to nature and community. Virginia Schaefer is one of them. Schaefer, known as Lady Oyster, shed a corporate career in Boston to move to the Mid-Coast and dedicate her life to sharing her love and knowledge of oysters with others. And now she's written a book about her journey. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, Lady Oyster joins us to talk about her metamorphosis and about the bivalve that changed her life. What inspires her? Not just the oyster itself, but the people she's met along the way. Oyster farmers, environmentalists, chefs, seafood enthusiasts, and so many others. Virginia Schaefer on Maine Calling. That's just ahead.
Support for Maine Calling comes from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure throughout Maine. Now open in Bangor, Waterville, and Augusta. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Have you ever said to a young person, "The world is your oyster"? Oysters have long symbolized passion and have been prized throughout human history. And they changed Virginia Schaefer's life. Schaefer writes about her oyster journey in her new book, Oyster Society: Adventures with the Shellfishly Motivated. Virginia Schaefer is a food writer, certified oyster sommelier, and founder of Lady Oyster Tours and Tastings, and she is our guest today. Welcome, Virginia.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you so much for having me.
And we invite you in the audience to join the conversation. Are you part of this vibrant world of oysters, or do you just have questions about them? You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Virginia, this immersion into the world of oysters, I understand, all started with a blog, an escape from your busy life in Boston. So tell us what you were doing and why you started blogging about oysters.
You know, I, like many people, I think, was in a very busy corporate job. I was traveling every single week. I was in sales and realized pretty quickly that I lacked any hobbies. And my favorite thing to do was just go to the raw bar and try all these different oysters and different oyster farms and kind of keep track of that. So I started just plotting, you know, what would I want to be creative with? What would I want to write about if I had that time? And it was oysters. And I have some really fond memories of my childhood as well with my grandparents and just this, you know, mindfulness and act of being present whenever we had seafood. So it all kind of started there.
And your blog gave you an excuse to start introducing yourself to some people that you may not have had the nerve to introduce yourself to otherwise.
It did. You know, it's funny. I was living in Boston at the time. And I was less than a mile from the coast and through in South Boston. And you know, to not really have any relationship to it was crazy. So just by cold calling some oyster farmers and getting out there, I actually really, there was a really cool reconnection to the coast, but people I normally would never come in contact with.
What is it about oysters that affects you so?
I think they're just the most pure, delicious, evocative ocean rock that ever existed. I mean, how special to have a little vintage of salt bottled between two shells that we get to experience and taste and just identify as different places. That's very rare for a food in general.
Well, in your book, we learn about some of the fascinating people involved in the world of oysters, but also about the oyster itself. So let's run through some fun facts about oysters in the oyster world. I was surprised to learn there are only five species of oyster.
Well, five here in North America.
Okay.
There's roughly over there's over 200 actual oyster species around the world, but only about eight of which we eat normally. And we're so lucky in North America, and I don't think we even know it, to have five different ones here in the US.
Wow. Can you rattle off their names?
I can try. Let's see. We have the here's the Chrysostrea virginica. That's our East Coast oyster. We have the Ostrea edulis, which is also found here in Maine, the European flat. Magellana gigas, which is our West Coast oyster. The Kumamoto, which the Latin word is escaping me at the moment. And then the Ostrea lyrita, which is our Olympia oyster, native to the West Coast.
And how different are they to somebody who doesn't know a lot about oysters? Could somebody who is really a novice tell the difference?
I think if you were to put, a West Coast oyster with an East Coast and really tell people to take it slow, they could taste the differences. But I will say, I've been with people and we've had the same species, and there's such a range of differences even within the same species based on location.
Well, I learned from your book the word merlot. Am I pronouncing it correctly? That in wine we have terroir and in oysters we have merlot. Tell me about that.
Exactly. I think this term was coined about 10 to 15 years ago and has really caught traction in recent years. But yeah, it's a really specificity of place of the sea. And it's so rare to have that because, wild fish migrate and there's other seafoods that it's really hard to say this seafood came specifically from here. But now with aquaculture, and just the sort of that booming industry, we've been able to actually tie an animal to a place and create a whole tasting profile around that. It's so great.
And part of what really matters is the salinity of the water and then the salinity of the oyster itself. How is that determined? How is that rated?
So salinity is graded on sort of a parts per thousand, if we want to get scientific with that. And our Maine oysters typically sit around 30 parts per thousand, where you might go somewhere that has a sort of a more brackish or fresh environment, where it'll take it down to about 15 parts per thousand. So we have really salty oysters in Maine, and I think that is just because we are such an ocean forward place for oysters to grow. And not too much fresh water that's influencing our oyster farms.
And you called the Damariscotta River area the Napa Valley of oysters. Tell me about that.
It's funny, even when I talk about it today, I call Damariscotta not only the Napa Valley of oysters, but the OGs in Maine, right? They started in the late 70s with aquaculture there. And they're kind of like our Manhattan, I guess, so to speak, of oysters as well here in Maine. The flavors there are incredible. There's this really earthiness, this minerality that is just delicious. A really salty river as well. And then at the very top of Damariscotta is Great Salt Bay, and that just is sort of a melting pot. And like an elixir for cooking food all day long that feeds our oysters down the river.
So I know that many people in Maine think we have the best oysters in the world. Would you agree?
Well, I'm here for a reason. Yes, I think so. I think really we do. And sometimes it gets shadowed by other fisheries here in Maine, but people, when they see Maine on a menu, they know it is an incredible oyster. That's the reputation for Maine, and it's so wonderful to be here and to just explore all the sundry flavors I think we have up our coastline here.
One of, it seems to me at least, one of the themes that unfolds in your book is this theme that in the past, this place, whether you're talking about New York or Cape Cod or Washington State, in the past, this place had an amazing wild oyster fishery, something that Native Americans depended on for their sustenance, and that somehow in the last 200, 300 years, that wild fishery
was depleted, whether it's pollution or over harvesting. And then you are bringing us to the people who are trying to do something about that, whether they're farming or trying to restore it. And I'm saying this, that it seems to be a theme, because that's not kind of how you're writing your book. You're just talking about these adventures with these different people. It struck me, though, that person after person after person was, if not trying to bring back something that had been there in the past, at least build on knowledge and a sense of place.
Yeah. You know, we have lost about 90% of our reef systems around the country. And that is, that's sad, because there's erosion issues with that. There's habitat loss. You know, oysters are keystone species. So if they thrive, everything else up the food chain does. And everyone in this book has this true, I call it like a noble purpose behind them, of wanting to see oysters thrive again in the wild. And turning to aquaculture has allowed our reef systems to kind of take a break and, you know, and repopulate themselves. But I will say, the overall oyster industry is such a positive message. It's not really doom and gloom. It's like, what can we do to improve ocean health? And I feel like I'm a part of that. I'm contributing versus just consuming a food. And that's really, just really heartwarming and great.
I want to come back to your story, Virginia. So I started by saying that you had started a blog when you were working a busy corporate job in Boston. And when you started this blog, you didn't think that this was going to be your life, correct? You didn't think that you would end up on the coast of Maine.
No, far from it. But this is what oysters do to you. You know, you just open the door a little bit and it's like a little cult, you know, you get really obsessed quickly with this tiny niche animal. But yeah, I thought it would just be a creative hobby, something that was only for me, only in my time, to give me that outlet and sort of some work-life balance as well. Yeah.
So how is it that you ended up here?
Oh, well, you know, how much time do you have, right? But I was in Boston when I started writing about oysters, and my job was in travel. So I got to travel a lot and visit oyster farms all around the world, which might be volume two, because we stayed domestic with the book. And then COVID hit. You know, the travel industry took such a huge hit around COVID, and the company I was working for lost 60% of the staff. So it was a really difficult time in my life. And, you know, I saw that business through and came out the other side, just really ready to make a change. And I had to acknowledge that first inside of myself before really taking that jump. I knew I was already itching long before the pandemic, long before these major things happened in life. I was already itching for just a stronger connection to nature and having that back as meaningful in my life. So I think, you know, that change, finishing this book, starting a business here in Maine, all kind of unraveled once I really made that decision to leave work. Yeah,
your business here in Maine, though, is a little bit different. You have not opened an oyster farm, and you have not become a chef. Tell us what you do.
We sit in the really unique space. It's called gastronomic tourism. And this is on the rise all around the world. People who want to go and see, and they want to experience food with story around it. So Lady Oyster Tours and Tastings, we offer primarily two experiences. One is our dining sensory experience, where people come to us for a sort of a performance, so to speak, of stories behind these farms, where they're located, taste appreciation work, all of that at a table with us, one of, you know, undivided time. And then the other side is that tactile hands-on experience, where we get them out to the farm. We dump a bunch of oysters out, let them cull, learn how to shuck, and just teach them those sort of those primal skills around this animal. And so those are ways in which we engage. It's not a sit-down restaurant. It is very much interactive and an experience.
And you've done this for how long now?
This is our third summer, so we're still pretty young, but we've grown the team. We now have five of us running tours.
I would love to hear some of the comments or some of the things that people who've come to Maine to experience your tours have said to you that you still sort of smile about, giggle about, when you are able to see Maine oysters in this world through an outsider's eye? What is it that you think delights people?
Oh, you know, well, we host in such a magical place. We are on a tiny little rooftop in Phippsburg on a working waterfront. A lot of people don't even get to engage very much with a working waterfront. So even that, and just teaching them about our lobstermen around us and the oyster farmers we have right in house is really magical. I will say we get probably 50-50 Mainers versus visitors, and I love that too. And there was something somebody said to me once, and it was, you know, I'm even more proud to be a Mainer after this experience. And I thought, wow, that is sort of that vote of confidence at home really matters to me, because we want Mainers to explore their own backyard too, and to get to know these amazing people along the shorelines that I've been able to befriend and also just be an ambassador a little bit for them. So that always sticks with me, that if I can make a Mainer proud of the seafood coming out of their home, then I feel like we've done our job.
Our guest today, Virginia Schaefer, her new book just out about 10 days is called Oyster Society: Adventures with the Shellfishly Motivated. I'm so afraid I'm going to mispronounce that. Shellfishly Motivated. What are your questions for Virginia about oysters, about the world of oysters? We're going to ask her about shucking, and we're going to open this up to you. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we're talking oysters. A new book tells the story of our guest's journey from, you know, liking oysters to having them become her life here on the coast of Maine. Virginia Schaefer is the author of Oyster Society: Adventures with the Shellfishly Motivated. What questions do you have about oysters or about the world of oysters? You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on our Facebook or Instagram page, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. One of the many worlds you delve into, it's interesting to me, Virginia, because there's the world of shellfish aquaculture, there's the world of environmental restoration, there are restaurateurs, and then there is the world of competitive oyster shucking, which, I've always, of course, known at the Yarmouth Clam Festival that there is a shucking competition. But this world is really lively, and there are people who are known right around the world for their skills.
There are. It is amazing. You know, in the book, I referenced it as the fraternity of the shell. I think there are just so many people. Once you get so great at one skill, you know, you want to compete with it. So oyster shucking just ended up being that. I'm sure it started really small, but now there's a global competition in Galway where people from all over the world come and shuck. And it's not just about speed, but it's about finesse as well.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because I think a lot of people have gone maybe to their local market to buy some oysters, maybe have guests coming in town and they buy themselves an oyster knife and then they think, now what, you know? So why don't you describe to us as best you can the proper way to shuck an oyster?
You know, Jennifer, it really matters. The shuck really matters. And I think this is something that we're all kind of learning with a raw food, right? There's texture involved. So we want that shuck as clean as possible, not just getting the shell open. So I always tell people to take it slow. Don't act like you're about to get in a knife fight with anyone. What I look for in an oyster, especially up here in Maine, you want to have the cup facing down on your tray. I like using a bar mat. That's kind of a nice, sturdy, sturdy surface that kind of keeps that oyster in place. You want to put your left hand, if you're right-handed, pressure down on the shell, holding it in place. And then you're looking for that little V, that little sort of corner of the hinge, and wiggling that knife right in there And we've coined this phrase called wiggle wiggle lollipop turnkey. That's what you've got to think in your head. So you want to find that hinge, right? Wiggle the knife in like you're jiggling keys in a lock. And you're going to notice once that knife kind of slips into a little bit of a pocket, it stops wiggling so much. And that means you're likely already in to where you can hit lollipop stage. And that's when you hold that oyster on your knife, almost like upright, like a lollipop. And if it can stand on the knife alone, then you're far enough into the hinge. And at that point, it's just a turnkey. You just turn the key, and that top shell will kind of pop open. The last bit is a little bit more of that finesse element. You want to glide that oyster knife to sever the adductor muscle that attaches the top and bottom shell. So you glide it nice and parallel along the top shell. And once that top shell is off, you hold that oyster in your hand, and we tell people to just scoop like an avocado. Really scrape the bottom of that shell to sever the adductor muscle on the bottom as well. And if you do all of that right, you want to see a fully oyster intact without a lot of cuts or, slices. We don't want anything to look pre-chewed. That's what we tell people at the table. And that's it.
And in your experience, Virginia, how many tries does it take most people to be pretty decent at it?
Well, you know, it's all about the right teacher. That's what I say. I think, after your first few with a really good teacher, they're looking pretty good. I just let people know, don't play with your food too much. Some quick, nice slices to get that adductor muscle off and you're good to go. But if you really want to get speed, that's really where things, you're going to need at least a few hundred oysters under your belt. Yeah.
I know that you've traveled the country and the world meeting some really inspirational people who work in this world, but I wanted to give you a chance to shout out some of those who here in Maine. Who are the people here that you want everyone to know about and the work that they're doing?
Oh gosh, there's so many. I mean, there are so many incredible people here in Maine. I mean, I will shout out Bill Mook from Mook Sea Farm, which was recently acquired. But Bill actually started the Shellfish Growers Climate Coalition as a part of the Division of the Nature Conservancy. And that has allowed shellfish farmers all across the country to have a coalition on Capitol Hill. And I think that, gave them a really good lobby. There are people doing tremendous work. I think Libby Davis from Lady Shuckers, she's has a wonderful woman-owned business featuring women-owned oyster farms. We've seen growing equity here on the water too, with a lot of women-owned farms in general. Emily Selinger, she started an amazing farm, takes great inspiration from even just, old native culture where women really ran the tide flats. I think that's cool to have that kind of inspiration. Gosh, who else? I mean, Brendan Parsons, Shuck Station, he has the same belief that I do around, how do we keep more of our seafood here at home for people to enjoy? We're not just an export economy. So I love his mentality with Shuck Station up in Damariscotta and the way he's built his business. But there's just so many wonderful people in this industry. Every farmer has a really unique process and are all deserving of shouting out, really.
You mentioned Libby from Lady Shucker. She was personally very important to you, right? I mean, you would not be here if not for her, I'm going to guess.
She was a really good friend of mine and it still is to this day. And I had coffee with her at a really kind of a dark moment where I felt like I was at rock bottom. And her story and inspiration made me feel like I was still going in the right direction. And also convinced me that I was a storyteller. Throughout the entire book, I was writing these stories, feeling like it, but I never acknowledged myself and where I belonged in the space at the time. So yes, she had some profound things to share with me and really keep me going to what we were doing.
A question here from Katie. I heard that oysters are one of the top least favorite foods in the country, along with anchovies, squid, and liver. Have you changed many people's minds who have thought that oysters are unappealing to eat?
That is a great question. It can be a very binary food. You love it or hate it. I will say, yes, we have had so many people come to our table who've never even eaten an oyster before, or have convinced themselves that they're just going to sit and have a nice glass of wine and give their oysters to their partner. And we have really helped them take it slow. We slow everyone down with taste appreciation work. We teach them how to taste the brine first, you know, get that saltiness going, and then have the oyster. And there's ways that, you know, that really change people. Once they kind of appreciate the story behind the food, they taste a little bit slower. There's ways to convince them, for sure.
Okay, so I'm going to slow you down then, because like drinking a glass of wine, it sounds like there is a proper way to eat a raw oyster. So you said sipping it first. So start there. Somebody goes to a raw bar or maybe to a party and there are oysters on ice and they think, okay, I'm going to do this. You pick it up. Yeah. Do you look at it? Do you sniff it?
There is a whole tasting etiquette, and we love talking about that and teaching people. So very similar to wine. You have a very similar approach to oyster tasting. The first is to eat with your eyes, right? So I'm always looking for a nice glossy sheen on the oyster. I'm looking for good meat to shell ratio. And, you know, the shuck itself, of course. I want a nice shuck. Then you smell the aromas. This is also safety, right? We don't want to taste anything sulfuric or fishy. You want that really ocean breeze, light, fresh, clean nose on an oyster. And then is when you sip. So you're connecting all of those olfactory systems from smell to taste. And that's when you're going to have brine, maybe some brothy notes, algal notes, all sorts of things coming off the brine itself too. And then lastly is to eat the oyster. And I just remind people to chew. You know, we joke that, you know, when you're indoctrinated into shooter culture, and swallowing the oyster whole, you just miss so many great flavors that are actually inside the oyster itself. So once we slow people down like that, there is so much more taste appreciation involved. Yeah.
Do you have, and this is a question from Cindy, do you have a favorite way to eat an oyster, raw or cooked, or do you like them every way?
I do like them every way. I think, you know, I'm not a purist at heart. I love being creative with oysters and cooking with them. But I will say I always try the oyster raw first. I think we want to appreciate nature, what the farmer has created, and that raw version of the oyster is already perfect. But I do love the good chowder. I love like charbroiled oysters, Rockefeller, all of it. Just give me all of it.
So you're not tired of them yet?
Never. How could I? They're all so different. I always say, like, my favorite oyster is the one I haven't tried.
Well, our guest right now is Virginia Schaefer. Her new book is Oyster Society, Adventures with the Shellfishly Motivated. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email, talk@mainpublic.org. What do you want to know about oysters? You can Virginia knows an awful lot. You can ask her all sorts of questions. And here's my next one for you. You know, oysters have long been considered an aphrodisiac. Do we know why?
Yes. And I think it's a blend of both culture and what's in the oyster itself, why it got coined this term. But it's primarily for the zinc content in an oyster. So zinc is associated with great reproductive health. So I think that's where the aphrodisiac came from. But also we've seen throughout history, oysters just associated with kind of like mischief and those associations, everything from like red light district basement bars to, old Roman social elite parties that got out of control. So I think they've just had that reputation.
That's so fun. Again, 1-800-399-3566. We're going to go to Andy in Arundel. Hi, Andy. Go ahead.
Hi, how you doing?
Great.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, if you want to get someone to like oysters, start them out with fried oysters.
I would
So
agree with
that's you
that.
just try them with fried, and then what's the second step?
That's it. Fried oysters are delicious.
I
And do you
love
have a
fried wings.
favorite sauce with your fried oysters, Andy?
No, I just eat them fried like clams.
Okay. All right, thank you for calling, Andy, about that. So fried oysters is anything not good fried? What would you add to that? There are recipes in your book.
Yeah, I love a fried oyster. And I think back to like old New Orleans culture, the po' boy, such a good story around, one woman who would feed all of the like the the workers who couldn't afford meals out of the back of her kitchen, fried oysters. And that's how the po' boy was created. So there's so much history around the country and different food preparations with oysters. So I can definitely appreciate a fried one when I come across it.
Yeah, po' boys are famous in New Orleans. What are some of the others in different parts of the country?
Let's see. Well, there is like let's see, the oyster omelet out on the West Coast that was historically from the Gold Rush, and sort of that Chinese diaspora that happened at the time. We have what else? Like chowders, oyster chowders that kind of were inspired off of the Cape, Massachusetts, and on down. And steamed oysters from like the gullah culture around Charleston, where you would tong off a big cluster of oysters, steam them up, and then just sort of shuck around them and open up the little oysters and eat them. So plenty of really interesting food culture around oysters and us, really.
We'll go to David calling from Walpole. Hi, David, go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to say my daughter grew up in the Twin Villages of Newcastle and Damariscotta, and she sent me a menu from a gig in California, and the beer was from Newcastle, and the oysters were from Damariscotta.
You know what? The reputation just precedes it. It is just, Damariscotta is well known across the country for incredible oysters. And of course, Maine beer goes right along with that too. So I believe it.
David, thanks so much for calling in and sharing that story. Again, we're talking for Virginia with Virginia Schaefer, her new book, Oyster Society. Our phone number 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. Today we're talking about oysters. My guest is Virginia Schaefer, who is author of the new book, Oyster Society: Adventures with the Shellfishly Motivated. You may know Virginia Schaefer as Lady Oyster. Share your comments and questions. You still have time to email us, talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram or call 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Kirk calling from the Waterville area. Hi, Kirk, go ahead.
Hey, good day. My question is related to the flesh-eating bacteria that we hear so much about that could potentially be fatal, and other types of pathogens. Do we need to be concerned about that for the Maine oyster fishery?
Yeah, Kirk, that's a great question. So, you are probably referring to something called Vibrio, which is a biotoxin bacteria. This is something that happens when, waters warm up, bacteria can easily spread. I will say, in Maine, we have such cold waters. It is so rare for this to take place. We see it in much warmer waters typically, but it doesn't mean that it's not always a risk. So my best advice is to always eat oysters with someone you trust, you know, whether that's at the raw bar or a farm with really great practices. If you're really worried about things, eat them in colder months as well. But our oysters up here in Maine year round are really, really safe. And if you compare them with things like salmonella, you're looking at maybe 100 cases of Vibrio a year nationwide and about 40,000 cases of salmonella. So the risk is very, very low. I just say, you know, don't pluck one out yourself without checking closures and other things that are really important that Maine does super, super well to protect us all.
Kirk, thanks for your question. A follow-up question here. Some people think you need to have some alcohol with oysters to, quote, kill the germs. What do you think of that attitude?
Well, I do love, a martini or a good glass of wine with oysters. If that makes you feel safer, I would say go for it. I don't know how much it would kill everything inside an oyster, but, you know, it's definitely a great pairing.
We'll go to Bill calling from Stonington. Hi, Bill. Go ahead.
Good morning. I'll differ with you slightly, dear. I do believe the best oysters in the world come from Wellfleet, Massachusetts on Cape Cod. And it's always been my understanding that the Damascotta oysters, which are more circular with a shallow shell, were called ballons from France. And although they're delicious, I've probably eaten 8,000 oysters and I still prefer the Wellfleets. And my comment, I guess, about the oyster industry here in the state of Maine is that they harvest them about 2 years too soon. And they're large spat and they don't have any flavor when they're that small.
Oh, Bill, you've introduced so much to talk about because Virginia has spent some time in Wellfleet and knows the farmers down there well. And also, Ballon is something I learned from your book, that phrase. So go, Virginia. Is this a matter of taste or is Bill right? Are Wellfleet oysters really better?
Okay, there's quite a lot there, Bill. Thank you. And you know what? Your call just reminds me how proud we are of the oysters we love and how it can like stir up so many opinions. I will say Wellfleet oysters are fantastic. And I start my book there. So, that first chapter is really exploring Wellfleet. I would 100% say they have some of the best oysters in the country, if not the world. I would say though, Maine is right up there as a number one. For me, I love Maine oysters. They are my pride and joy. What you're referring to around the Ballon is that secret species that came over from Europe back in the 40s or 50s in here in Maine. And it's a very different species. So that oyster tastes very unique, very metallic in some ways and sweet in other ways. Our Eastern oyster is the same as the Wellfleet oyster, same species. But I would say, you know, it takes about 3 years to grow a Maine oyster to about 3 inches. So waiting for 5 years might be a challenge for some farmers here and would grow them a bit larger. So, you know, it's all about size. Time, though, does not equal flavor. I will say flavor can be at any age for an oyster.
And Bill used a word that we hadn't used yet, but I want you to define it for us and tell us, he used the word spat. And that's an important word when we talk about the life cycle of an oyster, right? What is spat?
Yes, a spat. I love this word. It's sort of like, ta-da, I'm here. Kind of even sounds like it. So when oysters spawn, they spawn in the water column. And that embryo is fertilized in the water, becomes a tiny little microscopic creature that has a tiny foot that then pedals around for about 2 weeks before it lands on another piece of shell. And that oyster, as soon as it lands and attaches itself to a tiny piece of sediment or shell, that's when it's called a spat, once it lands. And that is the moment where that foot kind of goes away and it starts creating its own shell. So they're so cute. They, you know, when we see those little babies under a microscope, microscope there, just kind of fluttering around and starting that first stage of life.
So, Bill, I'm going to turn back to you. You said you've eaten about 8,000 oysters. Have you convinced others who are maybe hesitant to try oysters to do so?
Too hard, because who'd want to waste them on him?
You want to keep them for yourself and not share. Yeah, somebody's got to appreciate an oyster to deserve it, right?
Then that loves them deserves them. Did Jennifer ever know a guy named Howard Snow in Wall Street? They called him Pokey, and he was a town hero and used to send me home with 100-pound bags of oysters that were thumpy and he didn't want to mess with.
Did you say clumpy or thumpy?
Clumpy.
So basically more of a challenge to serve.
Yeah, they all stuck together, and you have to bust them apart, and they're not as pretty on the plate.
Uh-huh. So, Virginia, do you know Howard Snow?
I've heard of Howard. And gosh, yeah, I never had the pleasure of buying any oysters from Howard, but yeah, I heard that he's quite a legend in Wellfleet.
Bill, thanks so much for calling, and go have some oysters. Let's see, we will go to Westbrook and Christine. Hi, Christine, go ahead.
Hello. Thank you so much for this awesome show. I'm calling because I didn't hear the best recipe for oysters yet, which is something I had up in Pemaquid Point in Maine, and it's called an angry oyster. And I've made them many times where you take a raw oyster, you put a little bit of bacon. I generally par cook the bacon first so that when it's done, it's all crispy, so an almost crispy piece of bacon. Piece of bacon, a little bit of blue cheese, and some hot sauce. Throw that in the broiler for just enough time for the oyster to cook, and they are to die for.
Well, I was about to say, is there anything that's not good with a little bacon and blue cheese? But to add the hot sauce, that's what makes it the angry oyster?
Yes. So you can make them as angry as you like.
So have you done this, Virginia? Have you made an angry oyster?
Well, I've definitely used bacon before. I definitely used hot sauce. Blue cheese for me is a little bit strong on an oyster, but hey, I'll try anything twice. So that sounds delicious.
Christine, thanks so much for calling and sharing. Here we go. An email from Dave. Is it possible to find canned Maine oysters? And if so, where can I find them? The grocery stores and supermarkets only have canned oysters from China.
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, there is a new company and spearheaded by a woman named Jacqueline Clark called Nor'easter Oyster Co. And they are doing the pre-shucked oysters. And you can find them, I believe, at Sopo Seafood. I think they have a small little market there where you can purchase them. But she's kind of leading a movement and another person to highlight in Maine, where when you're a first-year farmer, you've got all these kind of what they call uglies, you know, these oysters that are not quite perfect for the half-shell market. And they'll buy them off of these sort of young farmers and use them for the pre-shucked market because no one cares about the shell or how they look. And she's doing a fantastic job getting that business going. So I would look out for Nor'easter Oyster Co.
Nor'easter Oyster Co. Are those are canned? Are they frozen?
They are. They're bottled. They're sort of like in those ball jars that you can purchase and then use them for cooking and all sorts of other great things, soups, etc.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so one of the exciting things going on. You know, one thing, we're almost at the end of the program, and it occurs to me, Virginia, we haven't talked about how it is that oysters are farmed. You mentioned these are larvae that swim loosely in the water column and then attach to something. And one thing I learned from your book is that there is a part of the process called tumbling that involves a simple PVC pipe. So I know that this is a long process, but just sort of as simply as possible, can you walk us through how somebody farms an oyster?
Yeah, I can. So today with aquaculture, you know, kind of different from the wild, where that oyster would typically, once it spawns and becomes a spat, it's landing on a reef or an oyster bed. it, technically, maybe it's parents, right? We, in aquaculture, we have to basically create that, right, in a lab. So it starts at a hatchery. This is a seaside lab, pumping in salt water, growing algae, where they're spawning oysters, which is essentially like one big, large hot tub. And then when those oysters are kind of ready to land, the technicians will dump in a bunch of what is called culch. This is like small little pieces of sand for every oyster to kind of land on and start growing their own shell. Once they're a couple months old, they're about 2 to 3 millimeters in size. They can be sold to an oyster farm. And that's when a farmer, just like any other farmer, will put in their seed order, so to speak, and get their 30,000 or 100,000 oysters delivered in a small little bag. At that point, they go to the oyster farm lease. This is a leased body of water, surface area, where the farmers can work and grow their animals. And there's a lot of process involved, right? So you mentioned tumbling, Jennifer. That is a huge part of it. It's not only looking after these animals kind of like a ranch, right? They're feeding off of natural water. You don't have to feed them. You don't have to give them anything. But you do have to kind of handle them a bit. Keep them clean from biofouling, from algae growing, seaweed all over the cages, all sorts of things. And tumbling is like a cylinder cheese grater, so to speak. There's like holes all in it. It rotates on a rotator belt, and you throw the oysters in and it knocks them around. And what that tumbler is doing is it's kind of chipping off all of that new, very thin growth on the bill of the oyster and rounding out that animal. So we are kind of like the topiary, like trimming your hedges, getting that nice, perfect teardrop shape for an oyster. That also encourages stronger meats inside, a stronger oyster and shell. So that process is pretty important. And most of our oyster farms up here in Maine do some version of that.
And for an oyster, you said they're harvested after 3 years. How many times in their life are they tumbled? I mean, does this involve a diver, or does this involve bringing up cages? And I mean, it seems like quite a hands-on process for such a small and a small bite to eat.
It really is. You know, when you get out there and you see the farmers and the work they put into these animals, it's incredible. You know, tumbling happens more often in summer months when you know, water is accessible to most farms, and they can get out there and really handle their oysters well. But every farm has their own frequency of how much tumbling they do and when. Some have like secret practices that they don't want to divulge, but I would say on average, maybe every 2 weeks to a month, an oyster is tumbled in summer months. So give or take maybe 20 times, 25 times in their whole life. Yeah.
So that oyster has been pulled out of the water and tumbled 20 times before it is harvested in the end and sent to the restaurant or to the seafood market.
Yeah, it's been touched by a farmer. It's been put through a tumbler. It's been culled for size. It's been cleaned. It's been put in another place on the farm. So there's so much that goes into it that we don't see once it gets.
And is this meant to mimic some of what might happen in nature?
It is, actually. This was kind of discovered by a man named Bill Reed out in Vancouver Island. He saw that his beach tumbled oysters had stronger shells than the ones he had in floating cages, you know, floating out in the water. So he just started mimicking that and shaking the bags out in the water, and noticed that they were getting a little bit stronger. So then he started playing a little bit more. It's just kind of applied science at its best, right?
Yeah, well, Virginia, thank you for letting us know so much about oysters, and congratulations on your book. Virginia Schaefer, a food writer, certified oyster sommelier, and founder of Lady Oyster Tours and Tasting. She's based in Bath. We've been discussing her new book, Oyster Society, Adventures with the Shellfishly Motivated. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. The Maine Calling theme was composed by Mike Jandro. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.